Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King makes his weekly visit with the latest in the immigration saga. And is it possible there'll be a hike in the debt ceiling with none of the usual drama? Then former House Speaker Sal DeMasi is dying from throat and tongue cancer in a North Carolina jail. His powerful friends are doing nothing to help. We'll ask you if he has suffered enough. Should his sentence be commuted?
Continuing our interviews with would-be governors, pediatrician and healthcare expert Don Berwick is in studio. Then, just in time for Valentine's Day, a new dating idea, bribing your way to love and romance. Then, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School on CVS banning cigarettes. Is this good for business? She'll tell us up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Tim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Spring is just around the corner.
Yeah, 3 degrees tonight.
Know, just,
isn't that exciting?
It is.
It's swell.
Ridiculous. Swell.
Swell.
So Republicans are renewing their calls to repeal Obamacare now that the administration has announced yet another mandate delay. And on the immigration reform front, New York Senator Chuck Schumer is offering this provocative idea. Let Congress pass an immigration overhaul now. But it wouldn't take effect until after the president has left office. So these are real-life political headlines. Are they as interesting as what season two of House of Cards will have in store? Joining us for his take on this is one of the stars of House of Cards. He's also the host of Inside Politics and CNN's chief national correspondent. Good afternoon, John King.
Good afternoon, Tim and Marjorie. The answer is no.
Exactly. Well, before we get to real politics, we just have to take a quick little trip, a side trip here, because if people don't know, House of Cards is this Netflix show you can get on Netflix. I think it's $7 a month or something like that.
Whatever.
And it's new season. The second season is starting on Friday. It stars Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright. Robin Wright that was in Florence.
Whatever. Go ahead.
What's the Gump's first name?
Forrest Gump. What's Gump's first
name? Anyway, I am just transfixed. I am like addicted to this. I've been watching them, binge watching them. And much to my surprise, who do I see like in the second or third show being called by the congressman appearing on camera is John King from CNN. So, John, are you going to be in season two? And did you get to see Robin Wright up close and personal? What's the deal?
I can't tell you any of that. These are state secrets. My goodness.
Oh. Well, last season, did you get to see anybody up close and personal?
No, I did not.
Oh.
They asked, you know, it's pretty simple. We sit at a set in a TV studio. Sorry to ruin this for you folks out there. But, you know, they called over and they said, we'd like to be part of this. And it's interesting. At the beginning, remember, this was this experiment. You know, this series that was going to be on Netflix. You download all the episodes at once. You don't have to tune in every week. And everybody thought, really? Can this work? You know, is people going to watch this stuff? And it was a huge hit. And they called in at the beginning and, I've done a couple movie things before. And sure, why not? We'll help them out. If it fails, it fails. And it was a great hit. And it was a lot of fun to be part of it.
And so for those who have not watched, I started watching about 2 weeks ago, Marjorie about a week ago. Frances Underwood, Kevin Spacey, is the number three Democrat in the House, who is the most vicious, most Machiavellian, most manipulative politician that I've ever seen. And Marjorie and I were talking this morning where we're describing him with all these adjectives. Are there this is a serious question for those who watch that. Are there Frank Underwoods or similar to Frank Underwoods populating Capitol Hill in Washington, John King?
Are there people with conniving ambition? Yes. Are there people who are going out to kill fellow congressmen to advance their ways? I don't believe so. I'm pretty confident the answer to that question is no. I've actually thought about this. He's sort of a combination. He's got a little, Bill Clinton in him. He's got a little Newt Gingrich in him. He's got a little Whitey Bulger in him. Let's put that. That
yes.
That is perfect.
He absolutely does. The picture of him with the blood on his hands on the Netflix screen when you open it up is quite apropos.
How much money do you think he's got hidden in the walls?
Hey, John, back to the real world or semi-real world. So the Farm Bill is this act of colossal bipartisan cooperation. The president signs it, I think, in Michigan State. MOU, as they called it, just a couple of days ago. We now hear that John Boehner is not going to attach something about military pensions to the debt ceiling. It may pass a so-called clean bill. Is this representative of a new era of cooperation, or are the cynics right that they're just trying to, the Republicans are just trying to clear the deck so they can focus laser-like on Obamacare leading up to the midterm elections?
Now, I would separate the two issues. The farm bill is more regional than it is ideological. Yes, there are ideological fights about subsidies. There was a philosophical Democrat versus Republican deficit versus emergency spending about food stamps. So some of that was Democrat-Republican. But farm bills are like energy bills. What do you grow in your state? What's the agriculture issue in your state? Are you an export state? It's kind of like energy. Do you have oil under you or gas under you? Or are you a corn state, so you want ethanol subsidies? So the farm bill is a little bit more complicated than D's and R's. And it took them a long time to work it out. And they did reach what I'll call an honest compromise. They just stayed in the room and did trade-offs. And you might not like some of them, but they did it the old-fashioned way. The debt ceiling thing is what I call the Republican strategy to me in 2014 is avoid the landmines. You saw the speaker do his about-face, a dramatic about-face on immigration in a period of just 6 days. And when he said, look, we have to deal with this, just never mind, because he doesn't want a civil war, essentially, in internal Republican politics. And the debt ceiling is the same thing. These are the kind of the debt ceiling, the government shutdown. These are the kind of fights that have the ability to distract attention from Obamacare, from the president, from the things Republicans think help them. So their basic strategy in 2014 is avoid the landmines at all costs and keep the focus on the president.
So the one thing you mentioned in the middle there was the fact that there was going to be some serious immigration reform, apparently, even if it was only to legal status as opposed to citizenship. And then there wasn't. Either the rug was pulled out under him by some of the more conservative members of the Republican caucus, or he just faced reality. Does this mean, or is it impossible to say, that serious immigration reform, not on the margins, but serious reform with a pathway to something, is dead for 2014?
I think it's most unlikely. On my show this past weekend, Andy Walter of the Cook Political Report, who's very smart and very funny, said immigration reform is like a zombie. It's not quite dead, but it's not alive. And it's just kind of walking around, and there it is. So it's the undead. And I think that's just about right. Look, Speaker Boehner wants to do it. Personally, he wants to do it. Politically, he wants to do it. And most House Republicans want to do it. But what happened here is a number of conservatives said, Mr. Speaker, don't make me do this. In my district, even legal status is considered amnesty. I don't want to have to cast this vote in an election year. And to be honest, some of the other pressure came from moderate to conservative Republicans who said, Mr. Speaker, of course I'll vote with you. And of course I agree with you. But I might get a primary if I vote for this. If we do this now, the filing deadlines haven't passed yet. I might get a conservative primary challenger saying, Jim Brody voted for amnesty. And then Republican money comes in, Republican on Republican, internal civil war. At a time when you look at the landscape, if you want to compare this to 2010 and 2012, not all of it, but most of the Republican money is being spent to beat up Democrats. Remember, go back to the Tea Party challenges of 2010 and 2012. A lot of that money was being spent to beat up Republicans. Now, there are some examples of that out there. Mitch McConnell's race in Kentucky, a couple other races out there I could point to. But by and large, the Republicans have decided this could be a big year for us. And the Speaker backed off. Now, after the filing deadline, when we get into the summer, is it possible? Yeah, maybe. But then you're closer to the election, and I just don't see it happening.
But does that mean then that there is hope that post-election, when they're coming into a presidential election, and that's going to be a massive problem again for the GOP with the vote being so heavily, the Latino vote being so heavily with the Democrats? What is it, 70%?
71 to 29.
Yeah. So that means between 2014 and 2016, we could see something? Because they have to do this to succeed nationally, don't they?
Yes, but we said that after the 2008 presidential election. We said that after the 2012 presidential election. Yep. That, the numbers don't lie. The demographics don't lie. They have to do this or else they're dead as a national party. However, look, a lot of this depends on how the Senate turns out. Let's assume for the sake of argument, unless something dramatic changes, Republicans are going to keep the House. Will they, gain 6 or 8 seats? Will they lose 2 or 3 seats? We don't know. But right now, there's nobody in this town who thinks Democrats are going to get the House back, except occasionally Nancy Pelosi in a dream. But the Senate really is going to depend on this. Let's assume, you still have a narrow Senate one way or the other. I think there are the votes for legal status anyway in 2015. But let me add this. Then we're immediately into the presidential campaign.
Right.
What about Ted Cruz?
What about Marco Rubio wants it, Ted Cruz doesn't. Where's Rand Paul? You've got three or four senators on the Republican side. I call this Groundhog Day. Because of the new extension of Obamacare, plus the past extensions of Obamacare, plus kicking immigration down the road, what do we get? We get another 2016 primary campaign shaped by what? Healthcare and immigration. Been there, done that. We might as well run Clintons and Bushes. We keep running the same campaigns. Why not run the same people?
You know, John King, on our radio station this morning, I was listening to the news when I was brushing my teeth, and they had this incredible story about this guy out in the Silicon Valley who was actually thinking of putting a cruise ship off Half Moon Bay in the California, in the Pacific Ocean, where he can house all these brilliant engineers and brilliant Silicon Valley types because they are not Americans and they want to be Americans and they want to stay there and they can't.
It is just they can come onto the land, it said, to negotiate
yes.
deals and to network, but they can't do the work.
Right.
So they do the work in international waters on a boat
off the coast of California. This is just becoming absolutely insane, particularly insane for our future is an economic, you know, big success story. I just think it's crazy.
What happens when they all get the stomach flu? Do they come into San Diego or they
to
Mexico?
I don't know.
Sorry. I'm a little punchy today. Look, to that point, this is what makes this so frustrating, Marjorie. There are 80 votes in the Senate to pass the high-tech visa part of this because it's good for the economy, and everybody knows it. There might be 95 votes in the Senate to pass that part of it. There are 80 votes to pass a new guest worker program. There are some disagreements, you know, between farm states and manufacturing states about just how that should work and who these people should be. But they're not. Those are the disagreements and the hard part that should be the hard part. They could do that in a nanosecond. They could do some of the other things in a nanosecond. They could refine the document process and the bureaucracy process, which is 1960s or 1980s based in many cases, and we've had so many advances in technology. They could do it in a nanosecond. But they won't because of the status or citizenship issue, and because now we're in the midterm election year because of the internal Republican struggles, and then the Democratic question about whether you would accept, something short of citizenship. But the political inertia just gets in the way of the three or four pieces of what you call comprehensive immigration reform could be done, by the time of, how do I get into baseball here? The pitchers can run from the bullpen to the mound in spring training. It's that easy, but they won't do it.
Hey, John, let's get back to this whole thing about midterm elections and the six seats or whatever the Republicans need to take over the Senate. Let's do one of those role-playing things that any decent politician does before a big debate. You're the Democrat. You're Gene Shaheen in New Hampshire, either with Scott Brown or somebody run against, or that kind of vulnerable Democrat. And the Republican turns to you and says, Senator, the president yet again postponed the employer mandate for workplaces with 50 to 99 people for a second year. Explain to me why employers should get an extension or a postponement of a mandate, but Jane and John Doe sitting in the front row, they shouldn't get an extension. What did Democrats say to that?
You've asked the defining question of the campaign, and look around the country at there are 11 seats. Gene Shaheen is one of them. Democratic held seats that Republicans have targeted, and they need plus six, a net six. The Republicans have to worry about Kentucky, and they have to worry about Georgia, and that's really about it. So the Republicans think they can take back the Senate. How does she answer that question? Well, number one is she hopes she said something back during the Obamacare debate. She hopes there's somewhere in the record something where she said, I worry this is too big. I worry we're mm-hmm. biting too much of the apple at once. Maybe we should do this incrementally. Trust me, they're all scrubbing their prior speeches. Did I say anything that I can use as a I told you so, or let's go slow? And otherwise, what you have to do then is you have to look the people in the eye, and you have to say, you know what? If you can't say, I told you so, you have to say, well, we're learning the hard way that this thing's hard to do. And we can pull the plug altogether on it, or we can try to fix it as we go. And you could say, if you were running against Scott Brown, you could say, weren't you in the Massachusetts legislature, and didn't they have to go back and fix the Massachusetts program once or twice? It happens. And that's what we're going to do. If you want to run away from raising access for all these Americans, if you want to tell people all of a sudden their pre-existing conditions aren't covered anymore, you have that position. I have the position that life is hard and we have to fix it.
Yeah, but see,
that's hard to do. That's hard to do in this political environment.
You know, it is hard to do. And my sense is that on most of these issues, and I know most of my liberal Democratic friends disagree, the position of the Republican can be said in 15 seconds. The response of the Democrat, you need a minute and 15 seconds. Another good example of that is the Republicans already have ads up on this nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office report, the headlines from which last week were Obamacare to cost 2 million jobs. Obviously, Republicans are saying, see, this is a job killer. And Democrats are saying, well, read into the report. And what it's really saying is there's so many good things in it that workers will have choices, may opt not to work because they don't have to anymore. That's another nightmare for Democrats come November, isn't it?
It is. If you read the entire report, there are a lot of things in there that if you're an Obamacare supporter, yeah, you could spin as positive. Access is already up to 86% versus 82% of Americans with health care. It's going to go into the 90s. You know, whether it's the 26-year-old who can stay on their parents' plan or the person with a pre-existing condition. You know, there are a lot of things in there that you could say yay. But, again, that's a national argument. Look at the map of where these competitive Senate races are. Even look at the map where the 40 or 50 competitive House races are. Most of them are not in places where the president is in strong standing. Some of them are in states he's lost twice, like your Arkansas and Louisiana's and Alaska's. Some of them, North Carolina won one, lost one. New Hampshire won twice, but his approval ratings are down. It's just a tougher argument for Democrats. And to your point, when you're explaining yourself or you're defending yourself, then you're not saying something proactive and you're not on offense. And you want somebody back on their heels in politics without a doubt. Now, this is going to be a great test of these candidates and to see whether they can turn it on the Republicans. What would you do instead? You want nothing. We tried something hard, and yes, we made some mistakes. We're going to fix them. What would you do? These debates are going to be fascinating, and we're going to learn the skill set of some of these candidates.
And they're going to be able to say, for example, I don't know if you mentioned this a second ago, you were all saying this website was symptomatic of the fact that this would never work, but at least a handful of months in, from what I've read in the last couple of days, healthcare.gov is performing far better than people expected it to be based upon the early disasters, is it not?
The site is working better now, which is why, you know, this latest extension is a gift for Republicans, because just when Democrats could start to say, okay, you're right, we screwed up, but we fixed it. That's what responsible people do. We screwed up, we fixed it, it's working better now. They're just when they could maybe stand up and say, you know, look at us, we acknowledged our mistake and we fixed it, then you get another extension. And Republicans say this is proof to them, this thing was just too big, and it's not going to work. I do think that the one legacy that may come out of this, and we're seeing it in part in immigration, is that, you know, this word comprehensive maybe needs to be put on the shelf for a while. And things, maybe it is better if we do things in pieces. Do that guest worker program Marjorie was talking about for the high-tech people. Do the pre-existing condition part, you know, as a separate piece. Now, it gets hard when you get to healthcare, especially, because you need to do some of the pieces to get the money for the other pieces.
Sure.
And so that's why they do lump it all together. I don't want to say simplicity is always the answer. Sometimes to pay for things or to, you know, if you take from here, you got to give to there. Sometimes it does require complex, but does it require, you know, 2,000 pages or 10,000 pages? That's one of the conversations that the country has to have.
We're talking with John King, CNN's chief national correspondent and host of Inside Politics, which you can watch every Sunday morning on CNN at 8:30. And you on your new show on Sunday mornings at 8:30, you talked about the five takeaways and some of the presidential politics. And one of the things you talked about was as Chris Christie's travails continued down in New Jersey, and people remember he got in trouble for his staff. He claims he didn't know anything about it, blocking traffic on the George Washington Bridge for days. That the hurt to Chris Christie has turned into a benefit for Rand Paul.
It has. And look, Rand Paul quietly has been working harder than any of the other potential 2016 Republican candidates. He's going to the key states. He's gotten some blowback for this, but he's trying to reach out to Latino voters. He's even went to Howard University here in Washington, gave a speech to African Americans. He was not well received, but he tried, and he acknowledges he was not well received. And let's see if he goes back and tries again.
What do you mean? Did people boo at him, or what do you mean not well received?
They took some of the things he said as sort of last generation or backwards language on some of the issues. But he said that he wanted to have an understanding, and let's see if he goes back. And part of it was, you know, there are liberals in his audience who think, you know, come on, what are you doing here? You're just doing this to check a box. They question his commitment. And so I do think the test of any of these guys is do they go back a second time and a third time. He was down in Texas this past weekend talking to George P. Bush, Jeb Bush's son. Jeb Bush from Florida, his son is running in Texas for land commissioner, up-and-coming star in the Bush family, next generation. And Rand Paul spent some time in private with him. Jeb Bush's wife is Latino. And, you know, so George P. is a Latino kid, and he said, what can we do? So he's trying to learn, but he's taking – what he's trying to do is fascinating. I'm not saying I agree with it, but, you know, he's got his dad's libertarian piece. He's got his own Tea Party piece. Let's be honest, despite his image, the guy's an ophthalmologist who lives on a country club in Kentucky. He understands the Republican establishment.
Yeah.
So he's trying to take these pieces, the patchwork Republican Party. Think about last campaign. You know, Romney was the establishment candidate. Santorum was the social conservative. The cycle before that, that was Huckabee. And McCain was the establishment candidate. We normally have these, you can put these guys in their box. You know, Michelle Bachmann was Tea Party. Herman Cain was Tea Party. Newt Gingrich was more establishment. Rand Paul's trying to take a little piece of everything and make it a more complicated, more ingredients in the pie. And if you can do that, it helps you because there are, you know, more voters of the social conservative brand in Iowa, but then you have the libertarians and the independents in New Hampshire. Then you're on to South Carolina, where you have more, you know, anti-tax conservatives. If he can put this patchwork together, he's going to build something interesting that in a crowded field might give you more sustainability as you go from state to state to state and the population changes. I don't know if he can, but that's what he's trying to do.
Well, he gave that big speech about drones. He was up there vociferous in his criticisms of the president with these drone attacks, too, which was
NSA, too, which, by the way, appeals to a lot of liberals, not just libertarians.
It surprised me. I thought, wow, I didn't expect it.
Hey. But he was ahead of the curve, on that issue, on the NSA issue. So when people see the Edward Snowden thing now, you know, he gets some credibility in the sense that he was talking about it before everybody was talking about it. And now he's going after Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton really strong, which is a reminder to her that should you run, all this stuff's coming back up.
You know, John, Marjorie really wants to talk about the Clintons, but before we
I do.
I read a story the other day about, I don't know if it was at CNN or The Hill or wherever it was, that Chris Christie, is he chair of the Governors Association right now? Oh, John. Whoa. John has disappeared.
Oh.
Well, I ask anyway, John. So, and I'll answer my own question.
We're going to try to get
him back.
Is he
chair of the Governors Association? Yes, he is, Jim. What exactly is your question? I think we got disconnected from...
Well, here's the reason we wanted to talk to John about...
Can I mention the Christie thing?
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
To me, the indication that it is totally over for Christie, and I'm not reveling in it, whether you're for him or against him, chair of the Governors Association, one of the great benefits is you get the campaign for people all over the country. He goes to Texas to campaign, I can't even think of the candidate's name, and instead of doing a big press thing, which obviously is what you want to do when you're helping the local candidate and being on all the local TV stations in Texas, he has to have an event close to the press because he can't handle the questions in Texas about Bridgegate and those sort of things. And when it seems to me that when you have a candidate who is not only so press-friendly but is so good with the press, which is what he was, who now has to, oh, John, here's my question. Obviously, it offended you deeply, so you hung up on me. The Christie question, John, is I read somewhere, again, I don't know if it was CNN, The Hill, wherever it was, that Christie, as chair of the Governors Association, goes to Texas the other day to campaign for the Republican, as you're supposed to do, and instead of doing a media rollout where he can say, hey, I'm here for this person, and by the way, I may be running for president, it's closed to the press. When you reach that point where you're appearances need to be closed to the press, it's over, is it not?
It's a huge question, Mark. I wouldn't say it's over yet, and I just want to note for the record, I wasn't hanging up on you, but I did say something about the NSA. This is the second time today I've said something about the NSA on the radio, and I've been cut off. That's a true fact.
Excellent.
A true fact.
At least they're efficient, you know? Maybe we should put them in charge of health care. Look, there's a problem for Chris Christie. He's in Chicago today. You mentioned what happened to him in Texas. It happened to him a bit in Florida when he was down there, and Rick Scott didn't want to be seen with him. Rick Perry doesn't like him anyway, but there are new candidates running for Texas governor, and he didn't get a chance to do that. He's in Chicago today. There are four Republicans running for the nomination, and one of them announced today that he is going to go. As of yesterday, we didn't think any of them were going to go. One of them now is going with Chris Christie. Look, the main priority in the month of February is to raise money. And he is raising money. I will tell you that what asked me that question in March, April, and May is the money still coming in. Because if the money starts to slow down, then he's in trouble. It becomes more of an issue. Would you like to have the Chris Christie we were talking about the week after his reelection victory? Then those candidates would be with him, and they'd be doing an extra stop. They'd be going to a farm. They'd be going to a business. They'd be going to a diner. They'd be doing something so they could get a quick photo op, in a more photogenic setting than a hotel fundraiser. They're not doing that right now, and that's a sign that other candidates are nervous. They don't want to be asked about this. They don't want to be standing there nervously while he's asked about this. So it's a problem now. It becomes a capital P problem and a liability if we get to August, September, October, and he's supposed to be out there sharing his popularity with these candidates in tough races, and they can't appear publicly with them. So the challenge is for him is to hope, A, he hopes he's telling the truth, and you know he's innocent until proven guilty in that regard, but B, perception becomes reality at some point in politics, and that's what's hurting him right now. But he has to hope the U.S. attorney finishes his job as quickly as possible. So that the investigation is behind him come August, September, October. And this is complicated stuff. We'll see if the U.S. attorney gets it done that fast.
We're talking with CNN's John King. John, one last subject I wanted to get to, we mentioned before we lost you, and you talked about it in your Sunday morning show, was Bill and Hillary, and of course Hillary running as a candidate. Rand Paul did take a lot of grief from some quarters when he and after his wife, they were, gave a magazine interview and talked about Monica Lewinsky, you know, back in the early 90s when she was carrying on with Bill Clinton, how this could hurt Hillary's run. And on the one hand, it seems ridiculous because it wasn't Hillary's fault. On the other hand, it brings back the whole psychodrama of the Bill and Hillary marriage. And you talked about whether Bill campaigning with her, presuming she does run for president, would help or hurt. What do you think?
Look, he's viewed much differently now than he was then. Now we have these new Diane Blair papers coming out for archive at the University of Arkansas. I remember her when the Clintons were running back in the late 90s. She was a very close friend of the family. So what she says in her papers will be interesting. Look, we are going to relive that. Should Hillary Clinton run, we're going to relive everything. We're going to relive everything about Bill Clinton and everything about Hillary Clinton, from Hillary Clinton to Hillary Rodham Clinton to the glasses to the hairdos to everything, health care. I could have stayed home and baked cookies.
Yeah.
All of it. Now, she knows that. That's no surprise to her. She's been through this. You know, one of the skills that she has is that not only has she run her own campaigns now, successfully for Senate, not so successfully for president, but she remembers all his campaigns, including him getting beat. The best thing that ever happened to Bill Clinton, he would tell you, was when he lost his reelection campaign for governor to Frank White. It humbled him, and he learned a lot. So she has all that experience. She's like a Bush in that regard. She's been around, you know, other campaigns, not just her own. She knows it's coming back up. Is that good or bad? Well, if Hillary Clinton, like Benghazi or like Obamacare, is in the eye of the beholder. If you tend to like her, you know, so she was blaming Monica Lewinsky. So she was hurt and she was rationalizing, easy to say. If you're a conservative, you say she's trying to blame somebody else. She's trying to defend that guy, Bill Clinton. So you're going to see this through your political prism. But does the country want to go through all that again? I don't know. What Rand Paul is doing is, number one, he's reminding her that you're going to have to go through all this, but I think she already knew that. But the other point he's trying to make, and this is where I got cut off, if I'm repeating myself, I'm sorry, is that he's trying to tell the Republican base, I'm not afraid of them. The Clintons, you know, because right. The Clintons, Karl Rove is the boogeyman to Democrats. You know, it's like, oh, God, Karl Rove has all these secret tricks up his sleeve. Well, the Clintons are the boogeyman to Republicans. How do they keep beating us? How did this guy come back from the dead? Who is he? And so, you know, Rand Paul's trying to say to the Republican base, I'm not afraid of her or them. And that's an important message to the Republican base.
Now, John, last thing as you leave, is the big question here at WGBH is, did you ride in the back of the truck or in the cab when the Red Sox took all their equipment to Florida last week? We're not clear where you were. Where were you?
You know, I was not there, but if you're listening, Larry Lucchino, I've always wanted to take that drive. You know, why not? People always say, you know, I was a catcher growing up. You must have wanted to be Carlton Fisk. And I say, no, I wanted to be Bob Montgomery. You sit in the bullpen, you have to catch 10 or 15 times a year, the knees don't get banged up, and you get to, you know, watch the guys in the stands drinking beer and the pretty girls, and, you know, that's what I wanted to be. So I'd love to take the 18-wheeler down and, you know, grab the equipment and have a good time and maybe have a cold one as we drive down the coast.
Why am I not shocked? John King, CNN Inside Politics Sunday Morning, chief national correspondent and star of our new favorite series, House of Cards. Good to see you, John.
Thanks for being with us, John. John is with us every Tuesday at noontime, and he is CNN's chief national correspondent. Okay, up next, and by the way, did I mention the 8:30 and Sunday morning show?
No, it's a great show.
It's terrific. Inside
week
Politics.
Week 2 was last Sunday, yep.
Up next, we're going to talk about Sal DeMasi. The former Massachusetts House Speaker appears to be dying in prison from cancer. Should his sentence be commuted? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Thank you. clinics that do a lot of Medicaid work have a certain reputation.
We don't need to have that inner city ghetto look for our patients here. We need to make them feel comfortable, and this speaks volumes.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, our series, Diagnosis Camden. Next time on Marketplace, it's from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Samets Blackstone Associates, for more than 30 years helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. On the web at sametz.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. There's no end to the bad news for former Massachusetts House Speaker Sal DeMacy ever since he was convicted on federal corruption charges in 2011. Marjorie writes about it this morning in the Herald. He was sentenced, you probably know this, to 8 years in prison. And since his incarceration, he's been diagnosed with tongue and throat cancer, which his wife believes may have metastasized to his youngs. Despite the judge's recommendations that DeMacy serve time close to home at the Devens facility in Massachusetts, he was sent to a medical prison in North Carolina. Has Sal DeMacy suffered enough? He's been in jail a couple of years. He apparently is dying. Is it time for the president to commute his sentence, or at least for the Federal Bureau of Prisons to bring him closer to home? And the reason we're having this discussion, I should be clear, at 877-301-8970 is in part about DeMacy, but in part about the Federal Bureau of Prisons and what the agenda is here. This is yet another federal entity that operates on our behalf. And while what I've learned in the last couple of years, Marjorie, is you don't want to place a gang member close to home for fairly obvious reasons. If you have a guy who committed a white-collar crime, as serious as it may be, and obviously the judge felt it was serious enough to sentence him to 8 years, even if the original goal was to make him uncomfortable so that he would testify in a grand jury proceeding about the probation scandal, which is what the conventional wisdom is, when it's clear now that that's not happening, they're essentially letting a man die in prison. With if his wife is telling you and Emily and other people the truth, and I assume she is, with virtually no medical care, far away from home where they can't visit him. And I have to say, I don't get this, and I should establish my bona fides, for lack of a better expression, up front. I thought, based on the facts that he was guilty, a jury agreed, I thought he should go to prison. I'm not sure he needed to serve 8 years, even if he was healthy. But surely, at this point, the notion that this guy is going to die in prison, uncared for, is obscene.
Well, there's another issue here, and Sal DeMacy was a politician. He has access to the media. You know, as you just mentioned, Emily Rooney interviewed Debbie DeMacy last night on her on Greater Boston. I spoke to Debbie DeMacy yesterday afternoon,
his wife,
too.
Yeah.
And what you learn is that there's a lot of people, at least according to Debbie DeMacy, and prisoners' rights groups will tell you this, too. There's a lot of prisoners who get dread diseases in prison, and they don't get cared for promptly. I mean, everybody knows the key to cancer is you got to get it early and do something early, or it spreads and then you're dead. So, you know, the pettiness that she claims her husband has endured in prison, you know, because he can't eat anymore because he's had such radiation on his throat and his tongue. He had to relearn to swallow. She talked about how he gets his energy. And prison is an awful place, okay? And they have all these rules. And one of the rules, you have to eat all your meals in 15 minutes, this particular prison that he's at. And if you can't chew and swallow anymore, it's very, very difficult to eat in 15 minutes. So what he does to supplement so he doesn't lose any more than the 60 pounds he's already lost, is take this energy drink called Boost. And she talked about how he was denied for 2 weeks a replacement of this Boost. And when you ask, you don't get an answer. Just like when she asked the prison whether her husband has lung cancer or doesn't have lung cancer, which is unclear because they won't tell her. They won't give her an answer about that. And it's the pettiness from not telling her about the lung cancer to not giving his prescription, not even a prescription, it's just a refill of this Boost stuff. You know what happened when he was unable to get any nourishment without the Boost? Other inmates let him share their supply of booze until he got his back. So if this is happening to Sal DeMacy, you can only imagine what is happening to people who have no access to the media. And everybody that does a terrible crime deserves to do their time in jail. This is not about letting people out early or anything else. It's about basic humanity in prisons.
Well, by the way, it may be about letting him out early. I mean, your view is at minimum he should be brought to Devens to be close to his family and get medical care. I agree with that. The question is, should the president commute a sentence? There's a great Peter Kadzis, now our colleague at WGBH, former editor of the Boston Phoenix. One of his last editorials, the last line was, DeMacy was sentenced to 8 years in prison, not death. And I think he said it perfectly. But look at this for a moment. You know, I don't understand. I don't know enough to know what all the rules are, except obviously inmates are constitutionally mandated to get necessary medical care, as evidenced by the fact that a very good judge, was it Wolf, I think, declared that a guy who murdered his wife is constitutionally entitled to the taxpayers to pay for a sex change operation. So the Constitution requires that, is his name Kosolek, right?
Kosolek.
That Kosolek should get a sex change operation, but the Constitution doesn't require that Sal DeMacy, mm-hmm. whether he's citizen Sal DeMacy or former Speaker Sal DeMacy, gets whatever treatment is necessary to address his cancer. I think there's a disconnect somewhere there.
Well, you mentioned before the thing where the gang member, where you have to keep someone separated from the gangs, but I don't understand why anybody who lives in Massachusetts is in prison in North Carolina or Oklahoma.
Unless you're a gang member and you don't want a meeting with...
Because it's not punishing the... It is punishing the prisoner, but it's also punishing the families. What have the families done wrong here? What has Debbie DeMacy done wrong here? What have the families of people who are killers done? And so you said... And how about children? Lots of these people have many children, and their children cannot see their incarcerated parent. And maybe the parent is in there for 20 years, or maybe the parent is in there for 2 years. And this gets to a bigger theme to me of our willingness to get steamrolled by the government on a million levels, and we do nothing about it. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Should DeMacy's sentence be commuted? Should he be let out of jail? Should he be brought back here to Fort Devens, which, by the way, is where Zohar Tsarnaev, the marathon bomber...
Well, of course, they would argue he's got to be there. I'm not defending this, but they would argue Tsarnaev's got to be there because, obviously, he's in the middle of a court proceeding. Listen to this commutation issue, which is totally counterintuitive. In the same editorial that Peter Kadzis wrote when he was editor of the Phoenix, we'll get to your calls in about a minute at 877-301-8970. Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton granted one out of every 100 petitions for commutation. Commutation means early release. You've done enough time. Do you know what the percentage is with Barack Obama?
Well, I do. I read the editorial.
One in 5,000.
And it's the same true for pardons as well. Reagan and George H.W. Bush were very generous with pardons. Bill Clinton less.
Pardons
so.
After your sentence.
Yes.
You're not serving a less sentence, but it clears your record. What were the percentages?
Well, Reagan granted one out of every three petitions for pardons. One every three. Yeah.
Wow.
George H.W. Bush, 1 in 16. Clinton, 1 in 8. George W. Bush, 1 in 33. And Obama, 1 in 46.
Sort of counterintuitive, isn't it?
It is sort of counterintuitive. I don't know what's up with him. You know, the big transparency guy turns out to be anything but.
Can I ask you another thing?
What?
Since you're closer to this case, and I know you spoke to DeMacy, and we know the lines are full. We'll get to you in about a second here. A ton of liberal Democrats lobbied like crazy for him not to be sentenced to any jail time because of the wonderful things they said he did as a speaker. And he did do a decent amount of things. I thought it was ridiculous. The issue is, did he commit a crime and violate the public trust? And the answer is yes. And he chose not to testify. That was it until he went outside the Moakley Courthouse and then testified to the media. But where are these people now? I mean, the implication in your piece from your interview with DeMacy, his wife yesterday, is that in addition to the governor, who says, I'm not interested in doing anything here, when the governor will be with us on Thursday, we'll ask him about this, is where are all his liberal Democratic colleagues who said he was the second coming? Are they lobbying members of Congress to call the president to say commute it, or at least call the Federal Bureau of Prisons and get him back here?
If they are, Debbie DeMacy's unaware of it. She said she has not reached out to any politicians. Her husband has not reached out to any politicians.
Why?
Because they don't feel it's their place to do that. I would say,
wait, a guy who understood politics, and that's how the wheels turn all of a sudden when the guy's dying, they feel it's inappropriate to call in shits from friends. It isn't like they're violating the law.
There's an old saw around here about what happens to Democrats when they lose
races.
Yeah,
that's true. You're right.
They are Siberiaized. It's really disgraceful. We heard Shannon O'Brien talk about that. She lost to Mitt Romney for the governor, or Ray Flynn trying to get a job in Boston all those years after he was the mayor. And I think that's disgraceful, too. He was on Beacon Hill for 30 years. He did favors for dozens of people. He carried the water of liberal Democrats on health care and on gay rights. Where are they now? I don't know. Michael Bellotti, the sheriff of Norfolk County, wrote a piece saying it's time for him to come home. Tom Menino, I believe, has been sympathetic to his case. But where is everybody else?
But you made a great point, though. Let's assume he didn't have those connections and wasn't as powerful as he once was. If this is the kind of treatment he's getting, the average lowercase s, lowercase d, Sal DeMacy from Chelsea, who's in prison for serving a comparable sentence, is totally...
well.
Powerless.
Exactly. Keith just sent an email that not treating a sick prisoner to the extent of trying to cure him when their disease is not treating that prisoner is inhumane. We're not animals. And I that's how I feel, too. This is absolutely inhumane. And as I said before, Debbie DeMacy told story after story of pettiness on small things, like making them wait outside in the snow for 2 hours to get into the
prison
in Kentucky.
When they went to visit? Oh, really?
I mean, 2 hours in the snow while people ask you a million questions about whom you're going to go visit, to making her son go get a different pair of pants because they didn't like the pair of pants he was wearing.
While Kosolek's getting a sex change operation for the second time.
I mean,
there is something wrong with this picture.
And let's face it, most people that are in prison are not influential former politicians. They're just criminals with no connections. So you can just imagine.
Well, he's a criminal, too. I mean, he is a criminal.
He's a criminal with connections.
Correct.
He's not a criminal with no connections. And that's what's shocking to me.
877-301-8970.
Susan from Newburyport. What do you think, Susan?
Hi, Susan.
I've been upset about it for years, ever since I read about the diagnosis. I used to live in the north end of Boston. I did work on his campaigns. I'm a big liberal. This, whatever, 54,000, 84,000, they let out killers, mafia killers, or when they have cancer, they let them out to go home and die in peace. And we wouldn't have the wonderful, it was a great health plan that he put through the legislature. Romney suggested it, but it was Sal who did all the work in getting it through the legislature. And it was a fabulous plan. I mean, it wasn't just some good things.
Susan, even if you were right about your analysis of his good work, my position on this is if he had never done any good work to help anybody and was not a public official, when you are in prison and apparently dying from relatively untreated cancer, you're entitled to decent or minimal health care, which he is not getting. And as Marjorie has said repeatedly for months, why is he not near his family? What is the argument for him not to be at Devon? So you make a powerful case for him, but the reality is he did commit a crime, and a jury of his peers said he committed that crime, and I think he should have gone to jail. But I would argue that there's time for some level of compassion. Susan, thanks for the call.
And the recurring theme to me is a government that's becoming increasingly unaccountable to the people that are paying the bills.
Well, especially since, didn't you write or did I just say or something? The judge in this case recommended
that he go
to the
Devon's.
Federal Bureau of Prisons.
That's right.
Now, the judge doesn't have the power to place him. But if the judge, who is a respected judge, or whether, I mean, obviously he's a judge, but happens to be a respected judge too, makes a recommendation, they don't even have to explain why they're rejecting the recommendation.
They explain nothing. She discovers, examining his medical records, that he has lung cancer. And that's right, Debbie DeMacy, and is trying to find out from them, does he have it?
And what do they say to her?
They won't talk to her, and they won't talk to Sal DeMacy either. This is just, it drives me insane. Mona from North Oxford, what do you think, Mona?
Hi, Mona.
I find it, too, that Mr. DeMacy is being treated like a medieval prisoner. He has effectively been given a death sentence, but not even the humanity of a death sentence of the firing squad. He is dying by inches like some poor soul on a medieval rack. That's bad enough. But then when you compare it to the Kosolek case, uh, Kotelik could have had the option of simply divorcing his her wife.
Yeah. He didn't have to murder her wife.
That is a fine point.
And if he hadn't murdered his wife, you know who would be paying for a sex change operation? He would be paying for a sex change operation.
Because most insurance companies don't cover
it.
Yeah,
thank you for the call.
You know what I don't understand? Mona, thank you. Marjorie, you may know the answer to this. I'm assuming if lawyers on behalf of Kosolek went to court, as they did, mm-hmm. to say he's constitutionally entitled to this level of care, it's medically necessary,
right.
is the critical term. Have the Macy's lawyers not gone to court and said the same thing, that this cancer treatment is medically necessary?
Well, he has been treated now.
Well, I thought she was saying inadequately.
Well, the issue is when he first felt a lump in his throat, before they did the necessary chemo and radiation, they rode him around the country in a bus because they wanted him to testify in this probation. Everybody knows, if you have a lump and you do nothing, then the cancer spreads. So that is the issue, that he might not have been in this dire stage 4, very sick cancer situation had he been treated earlier. That's the issue. And by the way, Debbie DeMacy did say, I could not get a response on this for the Bureau of Prison so quickly, but that she's seen this happen over and over again.
And by the way, we're getting some email. People are saying things. I know myself, and I assume I speak for Marjorie. We're not suggesting that he wasn't guilty. We're not suggesting that a sentence in jail, even though I thought 8 years was a bit much, was not appropriate. But the reality is, here's where we are, a couple years into a sentence, and the guy is dying.
Well, here's one of those emails is from Ryan. Thousands of prisoners in the federal system are sent far from their families. Where are the tears for them? Everyone in prison deserves a standard of health care and to be near their families. But to start with a corrupt traitor to the Commonwealth because he has powerful friends is ridiculous. If dying in prison is good enough for a minor drug offender, it's good enough for Sal DeMacy. Ryan, my argument is that a minor drug offender should not be in the straight situation either. Because what you're doing, obviously, if you put a prisoner from Boston in a prison in Oklahoma, or where's Whitey Bulger?
Arizona or something.
I don't think a lot of people have a lot of sympathy for Whitey Bulger, but you're also punishing the families and you're punishing the children of these inmates. So I think people should be in the closest prison to home that's possible.
Well, also, responding to the emailer, the beauty of the DeMacy case, even if he is as low rent as the emailer suggests he is you use a high-profile figure to point out big problems with the system. This discussion, if this is purely about Sal DeMacy, we wouldn't be wasting your time or ours, but it is, I think, symptomatic of a far larger problem. Again, Kosolek on one hand, and I know it wasn't the Federal Bureau of Prisons that ordered it, it was a court that ordered it, but the reality is the court determined that was the constitutional obligation of the prison system, and don't they have a comparable obligation to everybody in their care?
Kevin from Boston. What do you think, Kevin?
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you doing? I just think that, you know, within the prison system, there's kind of, ironically enough, a culture of lawlessness where there really is no accountability for that kind of thing. And, you know, these folks, they come up with needs, you know, healthcare needs and basic human needs, and we deny them that. And it's the same thing as torture. You know, it's the same thing that the NSA was the right of fourth, waterboarding and that sort of stuff, where, you know, these people are no longer humans to the system. They're just, you know, they're denied everything carte blanche, especially if there's a political vendetta involved, which I believe there is here.
Which, by the way, I'm so glad you brought up the last four or five words. You said something else has to be going on here for this to be happening with somebody of this profile. And for those who hear you, Kevin, I worry people are going to say, well, what is it? Kevin one of those guys who wants them to go to country clubs? Even if he's getting health care, it isn't like Sal DeMacy be leading a wonderful life. This guy used to be king of the roost, needless to say, and now he's behind bars. He deserves to be there. He deserves, in my opinion, deserved to be sentenced. But I thought you said it beautifully, Kevin. Thank you for the call. It almost is. It is a variation on torture.
Well, I think that political vendetta theory is that people think that this is what he deserves for not playing ball. He wouldn't plead. He went to a trial. He wouldn't snitch on the people that he may have been able to.
Well, that speaks to the prosecutors. How about his political friends, people who were his friends?
Well, Jim,
you think because he's yesterday in his news, they don't care about it anymore.
I have been sort of stunned that there hasn't been, you know, we have our whole delegation is made up of Democrats.
Yeah, I'm not buying it. I have
there
to say, I don't buy the notion
Hill
that nobody is advocating
that are Democrats.
For them.
Well, where are they? Where are they advocating? painting. Why doesn't his wife know about it?
I don't know.
If they're doing it, they're keeping it a big secret, that's for sure. You know who I think would be advocating for Sal DeMacy right now, if he were with us?
Who's that?
Ted Kennedy.
He might be.
I think he would.
And who, by the way, stood on the stage when that healthcare thing was signed with people like DeMacy and Mitt Romney and others. Let's take Stretch. He's in Dorchester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Stretch. Hi.
Yeah, that's weird. You know, the guy that put Mary Jo Kopechne down is going to get this guy out of prison. But you know, the thing is, you know, you guys, Marjorie, the column you wrote today was terrible. And let me tell you why. You got the guy that can get Sal DeMacy out of prison once a month. He comes on your radio station and you talk to him and you kiss his butt for about a half an hour once a month.
No, he kisses his butt for an hour stretch. Go ahead.
Okay, you kiss his butt. He's the guy that can talk to Barack and get this guy out of prison. DeValPatrick wants nothing to do with Sal DeMacy.
Hey, Stretch, well, can you hold it for a second, Stretch?
You should tune in on Thursday.
Don't forget Thursday,
and we
Stretch.
Will ask him about this. He has been asked about this by other people as
Stretch,
well.
Stretch, you know that horrible column? Marjorie wrote the column. She made the same point that you chose to waste our time making again. So as horrible as it was, she got it. Stretch, thank you for your kind call. By the way, I have no problem, I think listeners know, with criticism, but I'm not into this demeaning crap. So, Stretch, if you want to call back another day and have a conversation, it's fine, but I don't need that. Raymond.
Jim, chivalry lives here in the
No, it's not just about you. It's low rent, and some days we end up there, but it's not intentional. Raymond, you're in Providence, Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Raymond.
How are you? I think what you guys are doing is actually fantastic.
I think it's horrible, actually, what we're doing, and I think it's really terrible. Go ahead, Raymond.
Well, thanks. I do think this is a really important issue. I've worked in the nonprofit helping prisoners get out of prison and off the streets. I just wanted to touch on another health issue for people who are not Sal DeMacy, and that's the issue of HIV. We know that if we catch HIV early enough, someone who's HIV positive can live well into old age and die of natural causes. However, with lack of access to reliable and compassionate care that takes place in prison all across our country, people are infected with HIV and it isn't caught. And what's happened is that they're placed in infirmary when they actually end up getting AIDS and end up dying of AIDS in prison. And because contraband is banned in prisons, prisoners are not allowed access to condoms. So this is an issue that I think can be extended to, you know, public health for incarcerated individuals at large. And I just wanted to thank you guys for bringing it up.
Well, I want to thank you for bringing that up, Raymond.
But you know, it's kind of a sad political situation, Raymond. Can you imagine what would happen to the first politician who suggested that we provide condoms in the canteens of the prisons of America? I mean, he'd be driven out of town on a rail. That's what would happen to him.
Well, that's why we have people like Raymond. By the way, Marjorie, were you about to ask me, you know, in terms of due process for prisoners, I just thought of this when I was listening to Stretch demean us a couple of minutes ago. Do you know who one of the two lawyers who took a case to the U.S. Supreme Court that ultimately is the case today, 30 years later, on the due process rights of prisoners? You know who that might be?
Could it possibly be Jim Browdy?
It might be. It might be. I was co-counsel. And before all of you get worked into a frenzy like Stretch and others, it doesn't get people out of jail. It basically ensures that whatever constitutional rights apply to prisoners are effectuated. And that's, you know, I think that's all anybody, surely don't want to speak for his wife, that's all anybody, I know Marjorie and I are asking in this case, is that he get care that is constitutionally mandated. I think commutation by the president makes sense, but short of commutation, care for him and bring him home.
But again, there's a bigger point. We see this with the secrecy surrounding the Department of Children and Families, where you can't get any information.
You're right.
We are still months and months and months after that shooting of a Totoshef down in Orlando. He was involved with the Friends of the Marathon Bombers and may have been involved in a triple murder in Waltham. We still don't have the medical report from that. The FBI is refusing to release it. The FBI investigates its own shootings and never finds anybody wrong in those shootings.
So 150 out of 150.
So there is a theme from the federal government to the state government to local government right on down, where you have to go after and fight to get basic records for the taxpayers who are funding all of this. And we just don't – you talk to people about this, and they look at you like, what are you talking about? It's a very big deal, because what's the great line from the Supreme Court Justice?
What is it? Sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Who said that?
Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Is it Oliver Wendell Holmes?
Yeah, I think so.
I thought it was what's-his-name.
Well, it was what's-his-name. Now, before you go, Margaret, I just want to say one thing in the spirit of full disclosure.
Look that up, Jim.
That column you wrote this morning?
It's terrible.
Terrible. Absolutely terrible. I want to be clear.
Thank you.
Thank you for your calls.
Okay.
Terrible.
Okay. Justice Brandeis. That's right.
You should, it is.
It was Justice Brandeis.
What was that?
I
have the quote.
Oliver Wendell
And I had
Holmes.
The cord. I had the wrong guy.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to be joined in our continuing, our second round of interviews with gubernatorial candidates. We're going to be joined by Democrat Don Berwick. He's a physician, health policy expert, and he ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for President Barack Obama. He's up next.
What time?
Travel back in time with WGBH and experience the fashions, food, and music of the Jazz Age.
Let's misbehave.
It's Britain in the 1920s, an evening inspired by Downton Abbey. Thursday, February 27th, and Saturday, March 1st at WGBH in Brighton. Limited tickets are still available. Secure your spot at wgbh.org/events.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Art New England, a Massachusetts College of Art and Design program in Bennington, Vermont. One-week workshops in drawing, painting, printmaking, and more. Registering now, ane.massart.edu. And Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid from WGBH's American Experience. Separate fact from fiction surrounding the bank robbers who captivated America. Don't miss American Experience, Tuesday at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. We're joined, as Marjorie said, this is our second round of interviews of men and women who would be governor of the Commonwealth. We're joined today by Don Berwick. Don is a physician, health policy expert. He ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under Barack Obama. He's running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Don, good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for having
Thank you for coming in. I'm dying to know, because you are running for governor. We just spent 20 minutes talking about former House Speaker Sal DeMasi. What do you think? Should he be brought, if Don Berwick were the governor of the Commonwealth, would you be pushing to bring him back to Devens or to commute his sentence?
Yes, I would.
You would?
Yeah. Compassion is part of my view of how public policy has to run. And there comes a time when you just look at a human being and say, let's be compassionate.
So would you bring him back, or would you let him out of jail?
Oh, I wouldn't let him out of jail.
Bring him back to Devens.
Yes.
We should say formally governor wouldn't have the power, but the governor is a huge bully pulpit in these things.
Yes.
Should he or she choose to use
That's right. You could use your bully pulpit. That's correct. Second issue I'm dying to talk to you about, because you are a pediatrician.
I am.
The Department of Children and Families has been all over the place in the news, not good news, actually, with a child being died that they could not, a five-year-old little boy dying, that we think he's dying. He's disappeared in any case. I don't know where the child is. A lot of allegations of foster parents doing bad jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you were governor, what do you think you might do to improve things at the Department of Children and Families?
Well, first, I mean, my initial reaction is emotional. My heart goes out to this family, and I mean, could you imagine being in that situation?
No.
I have four children,
I can't.
And I just project myself into that and say, what tragedy, and it oughtn't to be. You know, my background, my whole career, 30 years, has been focused on management and executive leadership for excellence, how you get real reliability into a system. And I don't have access to the details of what's going on inside that agency, but there's a management failure here, and there, you know, the way I lead is to organize around absolute excellence, getting it right every single time, and you have to work with the workforce, make sure they understand the mission, are connected to it. As a leader, tune into what some of the problems the workforce is facing, and I think there are probably serious resource issues here.
There
in this
are.
Agency.
Well, they claim there are anyway.
Yeah, so it's a rededication to support to the workforce, to insisting on absolute reliability and excellence every step of the way, and then fighting for the underlying issues of social justice and commitment to people of disadvantage, which underlies the probable underinvestment in this agency.
You must have seen, as a doctor, some kids come in to you that were poor kids or maybe troubled kids or involved in the system.
Yeah.
What kind of problems did you see that are linked to the Department of Children and Families or these kinds of issues?
Yeah, well, I saw a lot of it. I don't know the exact number, I should, but probably half of my population were Medicaid, kids on Medicaid, very stressed families. And I dealt with this for 19 or 20 years as a practicing doctor, fighting every day to get them the resources they need. It was a real problem. The problems I saw were largely issues of fragmentation. So you had a kid who needed services. Often they were mental health services. The underinvestment in mental health, substance abuse, behavioral services is very, very severe. And I would have to fight every day to get services to an adolescent or a young person who was really in emotional difficulty. But the other problem was fragmentation. You often had different agencies, social service, mental health, corrections, schools, in which there weren't the habits or the support systems to have them surround the kid and really create a unified, coherent plan to help the child and the family back into the mainstream.
But so many times the kids did not get the help they needed then.
A lot of people tried, but the fragmentation was a big problem. And yes, they didn't get the help they needed. I have tragic stories in my background of patients I fought for. And when they finally got really to an age where they left the young child support system, they got lost.
And it seems to me that one of the reasons why, as you and I know Marjorie has written about it, the services are underfunded, there's not a huge constituency for poor people. And one would hope that even if there aren't – people don't care about poor adults, they care about poor children. But I don't see a colossal amount of evidence that there's this broad movement that we have to worry about poor kids either. I hate to be crass about it. So what do you do to convert the public mind is that, you know, but for the grace of you-know-who – you could be that kid or that could be your kid. How do you change this, assuming you agree, how do you change the political dynamic, the mindset about them, those people?
I do agree. It's a national, not just a local issue, but we're in a country of increasing income disparity, people at the low end really losing out, and there are many more people there than there are at the upper end of the income ladder. And it's become conventional to talk about kind of well-being of the mainstream without being able to speak absolutely clearly about poverty and poverty alleviation and the need to be a society that is compassionate, organized around social justice and equality as a mainstream issue. And I think we need leaders to talk about that. In my candidacy, I'll tell you, I want to talk every single day about reaching out to people who really need help and getting them that help.
You know, when you walked in here, Marjorie asked you something ridiculous like, so you having fun? And your response was, yes. What is the fun part? I mean, what is the fun
ridiculous.
Part? I mean, if you were, this is no secret. The polls show Martha Coakley's got 50-some percent. She's got a ton of dough. You're currently in the second tier of candidates. What's the fun part when you have so far to go and you have so many mountains, to use a terribly overused expression, to climb? What's the fun part, Don Berger?
The fun's climbing mountains. Remember, I worked in Washington for a year and a half. I'm big, deep sigh of relief to be back here. This is a commonwealth interested in the issues I'm interested in, which is that you can talk about social justice, you can talk about equality, you can talk about opportunity for everybody in this place, and it's a big relief. And I think maybe the most fun for me has been going around the state into living rooms and libraries and homes and town committee meetings and speaking a progressive language about, aren't we a commonwealth that has a vision about helping each other and being centered on issues of justice? And the heads nod. Everybody is there. And that's been very buoyant. And as far as the polls, I'll let other people read the polls. We're on a well-trodden path here as someone.
Okay,
not,
I'm not going to read the polls. I'm going to read the bottom line about how much it costs to go to college. You released an education plan. I know that one of the centerpieces is early education. I want to talk about later education. Marjorie and I have talked ad nauseum about this, what I consider to be disgraceful display in Washington when they're celebrating. They brought the interest rate down so it saved the average staffer loan recipient $6 a month, while the overall cost. What's your agenda for the lower and middle class and middle class family that can't afford even the $25,000, much less the $60,000, $25,000 of a public higher education? How do you get that, which it seems to us is as critical as graduating from high school was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, meaning a college education. How do you bring the actual cost down as governor?
We have to view it as an investment, not just a cost. You know, in the statistics in the state, there are a lot of people looking for jobs that can't find them, but there are a lot of jobs looking for people that can't find them. And that's because the education system isn't lined up. And, Jim, that happens where you said it's in the higher education system, especially the community colleges and the state-supported higher education, which are gems in the state. If we really invested in these places as preparing people for the workforce of the 21st century, we have a solution in our hands. As for people who can't access that education, we need to help them access it. And part of my education platform is to make sure absolutely that if a young adult in Massachusetts wants to go to publicly supported higher education and cannot find other sources of support, we should provide the last dollar coverage to get them into higher education. That should just be part of our social policy.
So this would be like a free community college deal? Deval Patrick has talked about that.
Yes. My view is that people who can pay for it should do so.
Yep.
But kids who can't, we should – look, we want to help people enter the economy. We want to create jobs, don't we? We want to have people be able to join the economy. Well, let's invest in people. That's the best investment you can ever make. So, yeah, I want it to be a guarantee.
That's the voice of Don Berwick. He is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor, former head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under Barack Obama.
You know, Jim and I have talked about this many times, too. I know about education. We sort of disagree. I think that the teachers unions have squashed a lot of reform.
She and I,
in
she
education.
Means. She doesn't necessarily mean you. We'll find
yeah,
out.
Yeah, Jim and I disagree about this, and that the quality of teaching has to improve in the lower grades for kids to be able to learn the basics. So how do you feel about some of these issues, merit pay for teachers or charter schools, which give more competition to the regular traditional public schools?
Well, let me first confess to some self-interest. My daughter is a teacher. She's in her second year of teaching in a middle school, absolutely loves it. My brother was a 40-year teacher, retired now. He lives in South Hadley. I guess I'm a teacher. My background is partly as a teacher. Teachers are not the problem. They're the solution. And of course there are some bad teachers, and we have to get them out of the system. That's true for any workforce. But it's 1 in 100, 1 in 200. It's not. We need to reinvest in the pride and joy of the teacher workforce. And that means giving them the supports they need. The unions will advocate for that. They're not always right. They're sometimes wrong. But I think they're on the side of success. They know that a successful school will be a good place to work. And when it happens that we invest in teachers, it works. I've been tracking – I haven't yet visited, but I've been tracking this really interesting story on Lowell where the head of the teachers union there, Paul Georges, worked out a good understanding with the then superintendent, Chris Scott. And they agreed to work together, not teaching to the test, not ticking the box, not MCAS, 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 but let's get teachers to really – grow in their skills and their ability to get advanced degrees. They worked, I think it was Fitchburg State that helped them. Well, they've turned around schools there. The Merkland School there was a level 4 school, a failing school. In 18 months, it was a level 1 school. And that didn't come from ticking boxes and carrots and sticks. It came from investing in the workforce.
But, you know, just as a view of the profession, every other profession, you can do well if you're the best at what you do. And you have to make a serious financial sacrifice to go into teaching because, you know, I mean, some of the teachers are paid well. In Boston, you make, I don't know, $80,000, $90,000 a year. But you're not going to make $150,000 a year. So why not, when you have these extraordinary teachers, pay them $150,000 a year, pay them $200,000 a year, and make that something people can aspire to by their skills in the classroom?
Well, it's a calling. I so admire people that are dedicating their lives to helping young people become the citizens they should be. And yes, I would argue for giving them more support. This is part of a larger picture of economic inequality in the nation and in the state where there's so little relationship between these soaring amounts that the wealthy are making.
Right.
Begrudge that to them at the expense of investment in other things that our communities need, like schools. Working on equality, including income equality, I think is going to be – I think it ought to be the flagship issue of the next decade.
But you want teachers all to make the same. You wouldn't give the best teachers more money than the teachers that are struggling.
You'd be very, very careful with incentive pay. People come to work to be proud of what they do. And whenever you have that kind of, you know, reward the great and hurt the not so good, you create many more losers than winners. And I'd like to encourage teachers to do well and have everyone grow no matter where they're starting. That's my general view.
Okay.
I ran an organization for 19 years as a CEO. We never had merit pay in that organization. We always used team-based compensation and working with the workforce to get better at what they did. We invested in them instead of creating struggles and win and lose situations.
You know, Don Berwick, most of America, I would assume, never heard of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services until the Affordable Care Act. You ran it for 16, 17, 18 months. The conventional wisdom on your campaign was that being there on the ground floor at the beginning of the Affordable Care Act, particularly in a state where it was wildly popular, less so now, was going to be a big asset. But you were also there at the time that the Affordable Care Act was beginning to be implemented. I've heard you say, in fact, you said it to me, but I think people will want to hear here. Why are you not responsible as the guy who ran the center for some of the worst that we're seeing out of the original rollout of healthcare.gov and all the rest of the early days of the Affordable Care Act?
I'm proud of what I did there. We made a lot of wonderful steps forward with the early stages of the Affordable Care Act, covering kids under their parents' policies up to age 26, millions of kids, putting in prevention benefits. We began to close the donut hole of drug coverage for elders. We put insurance companies under new restrictions. We had a lot of really good work to do. The contractor that was hired apparently really screwed up. But they
were hired when you were there, weren't they?
Yeah, but the rules of leadership forbid the administrator from dealing in the contract process as you'd want. You wouldn't want a political appointee to come in and manipulate contracts. So I was kept at quite a distance from that. And since then, in December of 2011, I had to leave under the Constitution because I was a recess appointee. I became under a prohibition of any contact at all that was substantive with the Health and Human Services Department. So all I could do was read the papers like you for 2 full years for the first 22 months of the rollout. I wish I was there. I wish I knew what was going on, but I just don't.
You know, I should know the story. Did you know the president prior to taking this, or he just knew of you? What was your relationship with Barack Obama prior to this recess point?
No, I only met him after I was nominated in office. My contact was at that time Senator Tom Daschle. Senator Daschle, you remember, was going to be the Health and Human Services Secretary.
Majority leader for a while, yeah.
And he was taking some of the lead in health care reform design. And I had met with him a couple of times, giving the new president advice on the direction to go. And I guess they thought the advice was worthy. And it was he who invited me.
So, Don Berwick, in any other state, the Affordable Care Act might be an albatross around your neck. Do you feel in Massachusetts it's going to hurt you or
no.
not? Because you are associated with it.
Yeah. No, I'm proud to be associated with a law that's trying to make healthcare a human right in this nation. This is a majestic step. It is very troubled in implementation. There are serious management flaws here, and I can see them at a distance. But look at the big picture here. We are the only Western democracy that has not yet made healthcare a human right. Now we're going to, if we stick with it, and if these enemies that are trying to take this law down are shut down, we will. It's a big step.
Do you think it is going to prevail beyond Barack Obama's presidency?
Yeah, I would bet a lot it's going to prevail. The reason is, if you ever tried to take it away now, there'd be public outrage because people would realize what they're losing. They would be losing the right to health insurance if they have pre-existing conditions. Their kids would now not have coverage.
I love the kid one.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, there is so much already good happening with this law that this attack, because of what's bad, and it is bad, the rollout's bad, is obscuring the real facts, which is this is a step forward for our nation, and I really don't think we'll ever go back.
Charlie Baker, who's running for governor on the Republican side, thinks we should get a waiver from Obamacare here in Massachusetts. What do you think the effect of that would be were that to happen?
A waiver? I'm for laboratories of democracy and the states being, trying new things. As you know, I'm supporting a single-payer direction for this state. I don't think that's the whole secret. We have to really do healthcare reform. It's delivery reform that's the real key. So care is more organized around your needs. But part of the reform, I think, could be a much simpler payment system, and that's what intrigues me about single-payer. And we would need some federal waivers in order to get that. Luckily, in the Affordable Care Act, there are provisions in that act that allow states to take some steps forward. Massachusetts has always been a pioneer. We are the template for the Affordable Care Act. I think we could be a template for a much simpler and more user-friendly insurance system.
Yeah, speaking of single payer, though, what's that great Obama line that I'll butcher a little bit? Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. What appetite? I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people, liberals in the Democratic Party, who love you because of the single payer thing. My understanding, you're the only one of the five who is a single payer embracer. Is that not right? Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, I believe that's the case.
But as a matter of practicality, when you look at the list of priorities for a Governor Berwick, it doesn't seem to me, looking at this legislature, that there's any appetite there for doing what you think should be done in terms of the delivery mechanism for health. You're making a face like you disagree with me. You think they could be convinced?
Well, first, my intention as a candidate is to say what I think, and I'm trying to really decide what I believe the best policies for this state and for its people would be, and that's why I believe this should be undertaken seriously. my face is about my surprise. I didn't know how it would play. I didn't make that decision as a political move.
No, I didn't mean that.
But when I go out, Jim, I mean, I'm in these living rooms and libraries, and I'll tell you, the heads are nodding. I think people are kind of fed up with the complexity and the opacity and the feeling they don't understand what's going on. And I think they sense that there are ways to change, which will be more accountable, more transparent. And in the end, more directed at health, which is where we need to go. So, Jim, I'm sensing resonance here. That's part of the fun.
I'm not laughing at you, by the way. The reason I'm laughing, when you use the word opaque, Marjorie and I are trying to figure out how to get a fishing license to go to New Hampshire ice fishing on Sunday, and I can't figure it out. And you can imagine people trying to sign up for health care. Hey, we're talking to Don Berwick, who is a Democratic candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of Massachusetts. Can we talk about some of the ballot issues that are obviously high profile? Mm-hmm. You have said, I believe, that if the Supreme Judicial Court approves putting the casino repeal question on the ballot, I am right that you said you'd vote for repeal. Is that correct?
Hey, I'm against the casinos and for the repeal.
Why?
I think casinos are a bad deal for the state. There's evidence here from other states' experience. They hurt small businesses in their communities. DUIs go up and minor infractions go up. The communities become less safe. They are bringing a new mental health burden into the state. Absolutely. Here we are struggling with health care costs with an under-supported mental health system, and here we're going to add gambling addiction to our needs. And I think the revenue estimates, they're inflated. We know there's cannibalization, so some of the casino revenue will come out of the lottery, and that's going to offset, I think, at least a third, maybe more. I just think it's the costs so far outweigh the benefits here. And you've heard our governor and our speaker say that they wouldn't want it in their town. Well, it's not happening in our state.
How do you feel about marijuana as a physician? We now have medical marijuana is legalized here. There's a great expectation that it's going to be legalization on the ballot, go the whole way. What do you think about that?
Well, at first, as a physician, the medical use of marijuana, which we now have, I think it's absolutely right. I've had patients, I've seen people whose nausea or pain just can't be controlled any other way. I would not deny them the relief that they can get from this. I think decriminalization, which we've done now, is a very important move. In fact, we need to think further about that. Our prisons are full of people who have minor infractions or mental health problems and not getting the right kind of care. For full legalization, I'm actually a little more cautious about this. I don't know what the total effect would be. I am a physician. I'm worried about the public health implications. And now we have experiments going on. Colorado's going to experiment for us. Why don't we wait? Give me 24 months. Let's let it play out, see what begins to happen. And then, sure, I'd be happy to consider it at that point.
All the candidates were asked the other day, I can't remember where the forum for it was, about the recommendation of the Attorney General Holder that the federal government would seek the death penalty against Tsarnaev, the younger Tsarnaev. I believe all five of the candidates for governor of the Democratic side said they thought it was a bad idea. Why is it a bad idea?
Look, I have no sympathy for the crime. Let's get that straight. But I think the death penalty – well, the Boston Bar Association said the death penalty has no place in American jurisprudence. It just doesn't. It is a form of punishment that is often unfairly distributed according to ethnic and wealth levels. It's not an effective deterrent. We know that empirically. And you know what? We're flawed. It sometimes is wrong, and it's irreversible. So I don't think it's the right way to be dealing with the correction system.
You know, I believe, unless I'm mistaken, you are supporting one of Jim Browdy's pet proposals. Aren't you a graduated income tax
Yes.
guy?
Well, I'm
Did you
for,
know who led the previous stalwart
effort
to
I don't brag about it. We've lost by a narrow 71-29 margin.
Explain to people what that is and why you're for it, Don Berwick.
It's a tough fight. First, we need revenue to work within the state. There are other sources. Healthcare reform, if we do that properly, we'll bring back dollars that we can reinvest. We need to get rid of the tax exemptions and loopholes that are just taking – there are so many of them. I'll keep the ones that add jobs and the ones that support the safety net. But not others. We need to hit the reset button on that. But we'll come down to the point where we're going to need some revenues. And I'm for fair taxation. And fair taxation to me means people at the low end of the income spectrum pay lower rates and people at the higher end pay higher rates. And that is a fight I'm willing to engage. Again, I think it's just. I think it's right. And it's the kind of commonwealth I think we want to have, and I'll take that on.
One of my opponents would probably say, Don Berwick, what do you not understand about no? what they used to say to me is the public has rejected this overwhelmingly 4 times out of 4, and what they would say now is the public has rejected it 5 times out of 5. I was the unfortunate recipient of the 5th no, along with the other supporters.
You did a great job, though, Jim.
I mean, have the people not spoken on a progressive income tax in Massachusetts?
I'm a believer that change is always possible. We're an evolving society. We learn as we go. I think the levels of income inequality that we're now living with in the country have grown and grown and grown. I think there's an extraordinary level of aggravation with this. People in the top 1% of income in this country have had almost a 300% raise in their income since the 1970s. At the bottom 20% is an 18% increase, and at the bottom, it's a decrease. Enough. It's time to engage in public policies that allow us to be a more equitable society. And to me, it's right. Those with great wealth, I don't begrudge them that, but let them contribute more because they can.
Are you going to be on the ballot? The caucuses started a couple of days ago. They run through, I think it's early March. For those who don't know, it's not that arcane. The system requires that any candidate get 15% of a vote of 15% of the delegates of the convention, whatever it is, sometime in the summer. There are five of you. What's the realistic expectation that Don Berwick, who most people in the state hadn't heard of, obviously your profile has risen pretty dramatically in the last few months, what's the likelihood that you're one of the 15 percenters?
I think I'll be there.
Why?
Because we're running a campaign right. I'm using everything I know about management and executive leadership in the campaign the way I would as governor. I want to lead for excellence and lead for delivery, lead for results. And there are, it's hard. You have to organize a field staff. You have to be all over the state. But we have a very well-organized field operation because we care about it. So and the response has been there. And as I articulate my agenda, such as you've explored here, single payer, casino, the poverty alleviation, and really the concept of a just and equitable society, compassionate society is fundamental. I think that message holds, and I expect to be on that ballot.
People like pediatricians too, Jim. They may not like other kinds of physicians, but pediatricians are right up there.
What's your website before you go, Don Berwick, so people can check you out?
BerwickForGovernor.com.
Simple enough.
Thank you very much for coming in to be with us today. Don Berwick is a physician, a pediatrician, and a health policy expert who ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. He is running for governor on the Democratic ticket. Up next, women, we're asking you, what would motivate you to go on a date? Would you date someone if he offered to pay for a tank of gas? Or if he offered to have someone clean your windows or give you a deep tissue massage? A new app is mixing dating and bribery. Is this innovation or just short of prostitution? That's up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Beth Daly is a reporter with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
WGBH is a perfect fit for us. It is a young newsroom. It has lots of energy. It has TV. It has radio. And it has really smart people with really great ideas that we hope to collaborate on.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now a partner with WGBH News.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Brown University's pre-college summer programs, where students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 300 courses available. brown.edu/summer. And Merrimack Repertory Theater, presenting Equally Divided on stage February 13th to March 9th. You can watch as one woman battles her sister and her own moral compass after the death of her antique-collecting mother. MRT.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Gann. MIT is known as the birthplace of a ton of life-changing inventions. The human genome came out of MIT, as did the World Wide Web, the transistor radio, the black box that's used in aircraft carriers, and now CarrotDating.com. I'm so embarrassed by this. The world's first bribe for a date site and app. The premise behind Carrot Dating, Marjorie just described, is this. Men can get dates with beautiful women by offering a bribe, essentially. The 10 most successful first date bribes include things like flowers, chocolate, plastic surgery, a day at the spa, etc. So is this a dating model that either appeals to you now, or if you're not dating anymore, would have appealed to you then? Women, would you be more inclined to date a stranger if you promised to have someone clean your house, if you promised to take your dog to the groomer, that sort of thing? Or is this just a little too close to prostitution? 877 301-8970. My favorite part of the story, which we'd like you to weigh in on, is not just the whether or not this approach, this fairly unusual creative approach to dating, is one you find appropriate or offensive. My favorite part of this, and this was pointed out to us by our colleague Christina Quinn, is in different cities, there are different things that are at the top of the list in terms of enticing people to go out with you. In Los Angeles, number one on the list is jewelry.
Right.
In New York City, it's a spa treatment. What is number one? And this is unbelievable. What is number one in Boston, Marjorie?
Free tank of gas, too.
Free tank of gas. So we want to know. We're serious about this at 877-301-8970. Not only what do you think about carrotdating.com, but secondly, what explains the fact that in Boston, the greatest incentive to go out on that date that you're so-so about is a full tank of gas rather than the spa treatment in New York City or the jewelry in Los Angeles? How do you explain that, by the way?
What, the free tank
the
of gas?
The free tank of gas?
I think we're very practical. We're very practical. We don't want to get jewelry from people we don't even know that we made on some dating site or spa treatments. It's kind of creepy.
But gas is
not personal, you know. It's not close to you. It's just
maybe that is what it
bucks
is. It's less intimate, yeah.
Yeah, it's less intimate. And, you know, this sounds ridiculous on one hand to say to yourself, who's going to do this? Well, the guy that started it is kind of a nerdy guy, self-proclaimed nerdy, lonely guy, even though he's happily married now. And he figured this is a way for nerdy guys to have a chance to go out with some attractive women that they were interested in because they were bringing something to the table more than just the free meal. Although, as I said to you before the show, I've heard from many 20-something women that one of the main reasons they go to these different websites, the Cupid.com or the 20somethinglove.com, whatever they are, is to get free meals when they're students.
You're serious, by the way, of course.
Yes, yes. If you know, you're a student, you're a graduate student, you're broke, you're 25 years old, I mean, you know, you go out in a couple of days, you get a couple of nice meals, and maybe you like the guy, maybe you don't, but what the heck, you have some nice conversation. So this time, it goes beyond the nice meal. You get yourself $50 if you have a big car, you know, free tank. You know, say, you know, you're getting by a little bit of, money. I mean,
if you have a smart car, you might ask for two tanks of gas. 877-301-8970. One of the reasons we're talking about this, my initial reaction to this
Valentine's Day, Jim, sort of a prostitutional kind of thing.
But then I said to myself, when I was in college, I would have done this in a second. I mean, it's I don't know why there's such this huge divide where my initial, I smiled and thought it was sort of cute, but God, it's offensive. But then I said, of course, when you're a college kid or you're out of high school,
right,
you're not making a ton
you're
of
broke.
Dough. Why not, I guess, is the notion. But there obviously are mixed feelings about this. And this guy, this MIT grad, is a rather controversial figure
well,
in the dating
sounds,
world.
He sounds a little, I mean, some of the things he says in the Boston Magazine piece I kind of found rather offensive. He's been accused of being a misogynist, and he may be, I have no idea if he is or if he isn't.
30,000 people have downloaded the app.
That's
that
right.
Is a lot of people.
Well, again, usually you just go out for a date and if it works out or it doesn't work out, but you're just basically getting a meal, probably not that great a meal. You're probably getting some cheap meal, or even worse, you're meeting for coffee. You know, you're getting a donut or a pastry and a cup of coffee. This way, like I said, if you are an attractive woman and a smart woman and a fun woman with a sense of humor, you get a little something extra. What the heck?
Apparently. 877-301-8970. We're only going to spend a few minutes on this. We want to get a sense of what you think of this. What is it called? Carrot dating.
Carrot dating.
You got to say give this for
it's
the guy.
Very,
the guy is a creative character, even if he's
creative.
An offensive character. No, I'm serious. I mean, he has had some other enterprises
well,
that have...
Yes, seekingarrangements.com. That's
yeah, what
another
is that
one of
again?
His enterprises. Well, that is...
Well, actually, let's not get into that. Now I think of it. Let's just stay right where we are now that I look at it. 877-301-8970. Just a few minutes. So if you want to get in there now. Let's start with Lorna. You're in Auburn. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi there, Lorna.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
I love listening to your show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Listener. Yeah, as far as dating thing is concerned, I think that, you know, there are a lot of young women that would love to have a date, would probably love to try something like this. But I also think that there's a lot of young women who don't need a date at all. And I think they're probably fine on their own.
Yeah, but they may need a tank of gas.
Yes.
Even if they don't need a date.
Yes, then definitely. Yes, they need a tank of gas, definitely. But I do think there are more and more women nowadays that feel that they don't need dates or don't need to be have a man.
That's right.
I think that is totally true. But
what's
Lorna,
the Gloria Steinem line? Woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle
or something like that.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
It was Oliver Wendell Holmes, I think.
Oliver Wendell Holmes.
I'm sorry,
yeah,
what, Lorna?
A lot of women, a lot of women are made to feel that they should be with a man, or you know how that is.
Well, that's actually a little broader statement than we were suggesting here. But Laura, you make a fine point, and thank
you.
Right. We have a big connection. We've got to let you go. Thanks for the call.
Men are expendable. In other words, they're overrated. I hope that doesn't make you feel better.
No, listen, give me a tank of gas, and I'm there.
877-301-8970.
You made a very insightful point, though.
What?
I mean, how much the date is valued ultimately is a function of what size car you have. I mean, if it turns out. You offer a tank of gas, and the next question you ask before you agree to the date is like, what kind of car do you drive?
Well, you have to tell them you have an SUV, whether you don't or not. You have a big Chevy Suburban.
I have an Escalade.
Yeah, it takes about
or a Suburban, right,
20
which is the size of a tank
or something like that. But, you know, I mean, people, mostly this is a 20-something kind of thing, and I think that people...
Why is this different? That, in all seriousness, getting back to the thing you mentioned before, that you've interviewed a lot of 20-somethings who say, I often go onto those websites because I want to find a decent person who'll buy my dinner. I'm not looking... No, I'm serious. You said it. I'm not saying it. Why is this... I mean, I have the same visceral reaction most people with whom we discussed this had, which was negative. Why is this any different than expecting, whether you're a man or a woman, that the person who asks you out in some cases is going to end up paying for your meal? Why is that any different?
I don't see it as that much different. I just think, the guy that started this is a little bit of a nerdy guy.
He admits that,
So I think what he's saying is that if you have a chance as a nerd, that if someone will spend dinner with you, then maybe they'll find you a fun guy to hang around with, and you're just giving them an added incentive. They might not otherwise go out with you. That's what he's saying.
I totally agree with you, your analysis of why the tank of gas feels okay, because it's not intimate, as opposed to jewelry.
Yeah.
It should be called tankofgas.com instead of carrotdating.com. I mean, I can see that. You know, we'll go out, we'll have a date, and I'll fill up your gas tank. I mean, that's
exactly.
That feels okay.
And I'll pay for your dinner as well, and we're not going to go to McDonald's. We're going to go to a halfway decent restaurant.
And by the way, you can say no. I mean, let's be clear here. This is not a mandate. This is not like you sign up, and if some guy or woman offers you one of these things that you are required
Match.com. I mean, you make your offer, and someone either takes your offer or they refuse your offer and move on to the next person. Ashley and Lynn, what do you think, Ashley?
Hey there.
Oh, my God, I'm so starstruck right now.
Hey, Ashley, welcome.
I think it's hilarious that women from Boston want gas, but I think that's what I would want, too. I would feel bad if someone was like, oh, go out with me. I'll get you this $500 necklace. Like,
that's
right. I feel bad, but I think it's a great idea. Like, if it's showing that these guys do have something to offer, and like you guys said, like, maybe women will see more than that.
Exactly.
They just need a little push.
It's a door opener, or in this case, a gas cap opener, I guess you could say. Ashley, excellent call. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Let's go to Anonymous in Andover.
Oh,
what do you
trouble.
Think, Anonymous?
Well, hey there. I was in a call center, and this fella asked me out almost daily for week after week after week, and I said no. And one day he said, please go out. I have backstage passes to the Gypsy Kings. And I said, yes, I will go. And it turned out to be awful. He didn't have backstage passes. I had to drive. He didn't have any money. And we were seated so far back, the alphabet started repeating itself. So we weren't even in A through Z. We were in row MM. And
oh, no.
So it was not endearing, his perseverance. And sometimes that can be endearing.
See, maybe the whole thing may be a scam. By the way, that's one of the best lines you've heard on the show. When the alphabet starts repeating, you know you're in trouble. That's a very fine.
I guess you have to demand to see the tickets first.
Yeah, so how did this end, Anonymous? How did this whole thing end with the Gypsy Kings thing? How did this end?
I drove home and he got a cab from the...
That is a...
He did not ask again.
Well, apparently not, and you wouldn't have gone again. That's a great story, Anonymous. A wonderful way to wrap it up. Thank you for the
If you're interested in any of this, if this sounds good
don't
to
even
you,
give
what is the website?
No, forget it.
Carrotdating.com.
No, she's right. Anonymous is right. Forget this whole thing. We shouldn't even talk about it.
Okay. Jim is very upset. It was a nice little Valentine's Day thing, Jim. That's what we thought. Anyway, up next is Nancy Kang. She's going to join us for open mic. Now that CVS is banning public health enemy number one by getting rid of cigarettes, is what's good for our health good for business too? That subject is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Thank you.
Have you heard the one about the Imam, Snow White, and the Seven Dwarfs?
We are Muslim. We don't criticize the actual religion itself. We criticize behavior.
The humor and satire of the online publication The Hummus. Muslim life in America takes a licking while the religion comes out okay. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And the Baker Library Bloomberg Center at Harvard Business School, now exhibiting the art of American advertising with ads, trade cards, and catalogs from the dawn of modern advertising. Info at library.hbs.edu. And Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru XV Crosstech Hybrid with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. And her latest book is Ernest Shackleton. This is about to be a new one, by the way. Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, good to see you.
Always great to be here.
So the question, as I said when I was announcing that you were coming, is people know that CVS's that are have pharmacies in them are banning cigarettes, and some without pharmacies have banned them as well. So is this just about the bottom line here, or is there a connection between they're doing what's good for our health, good for their bottom line?
I think the answer is it's both, Marjorie. So what is happening to CVS is that they are becoming a healthcare company. We think of them as a drugstore, but they're becoming a healthcare company. So I did some financial digging today. Let's remember there are about 7,600 CVS stores in America. Their revenue for last year, get this, listen, $126 billion. Now, a big hunk of that, and this is where we get to the healthcare part, and that takes us to the bottom line part, comes from a company called Caremark that they acquired about 6-7 years ago, 2007. Caremark is what's called a health benefits pharmacy benefits management company. So they help manage all those different insurance programs that we have that give you the $7 prescription, right? And they own that. And a big hunk of that $126 billion, like I couldn't parse it out in the 10-K and SEC filing, but close to $80 billion of the $126 is from basically managing pharmacy insurance. And then if you look at the next big revenue raiser, come to profit in a second because that's the bottom line, the next big revenue raiser is their pharmacies. They have 26,000 pharmacists and nurse practitioners working in those 7,600 stores. Then, right, think about something called MinuteClinic, which CVS has been the most progressive, the most advanced, the most aggressive.
They're great.
Doctor's office. Or a flu shot or whatever, right?
Or strep throat,
yeast infection, children's earache, the most common ailments that drive us either to a doctor's appointment if we can get one before the pain and whatever aggro of our illness, right, doesn't kill us, or often, believe it or not, increasingly after-hours care or an emergency room.
Oh, and you're there for – that happened to me a million times when my kids were little with ear infections or strep throats. You're 6 hours in the emergency room at Children's Hospital.
Right, and all you really need is some kind of quick, you know, snap test and then a proper drug prescription for an antibiotic. So it makes so much sense cost-wise, convenience-wise, health-wise, to have those things. So CVS has about 750 of them now, of the 7,600, so a tenth of the stores. Larry Menlow, the CEO, who's clearly overseen a lot of this, has said we're going to double that number in the next 3 years. So they are becoming a healthcare company. And then if you look at where they make their bottom line, because this is what they're positioning themselves, not just to be, you know, a drugstore, but to be seriously a place where you can manage a whole bunch of healthcare needs and do it within the increasingly important purview of the Affordable Care Act, which we all know, you've talked about this a lot on the show, is going to put a great premium on efficiency, cost management, you know, cost-effective outcomes. CVS is like remaking themselves for this new world. I think it's fascinating, and they are certainly not doing it if they don't think it's going to feed the bottom line. So that led me into thinking about how profitable are cigarettes? They say they're going to lose $2 billion in a year in sales of cigarettes. So that's just a small portion of $126 billion. about $72 million in what would otherwise be earnings per share. So that's net income. So that's not trivial, but it's not a huge hunk of the over $5.5 billion they earned last year in profit. So cigarettes, it turns out, the average margin on cigarettes is actually somewhere, less than 20%, much less than 20%. It's, even though that pack of Marlboros, I learned, because I don't smoke, costs as much as $10 in Boston.
Yeah, it's crazy.
A carton can cost $100. Mm-hmm. A huge amount of that is taxes, right? Even though you have these big price tags, the actual margins are much smaller than, say, selling a liter bottle of Coke. Or for pharmacies and drugstores, selling beauty products where the margins, the gross margins, can be as high as 50%.
So 20% obviously then is
much
quite
smaller,
low.
much smaller, right?
And like, smaller than the healthcare services margin
than the pharmacy sales, the drug sales. So this company is very foresighted. And what I think is so fascinating about it from a historian standpoint is here's the world of healthcare being remade for lots of different reasons, including government regulation and the economics of the whole, right? The efficiency and possibility of the whole economy. And here's a company that's literally reinventing itself as we speak, right? And, God bless it, it's headquartered in Woonsocket. Right, I think CVS comes from
socket.
Consumer Value Store.
Like
it has
trivia question.
It has kind of a nice, solid historical footprint, and now here they are on the cutting edge of the new world. I think it's just a great story, great strategy.
So when the American Cancer Society came out about a minute and a half after they said no to cigarettes to say, "quote, it was an act of corporate courage," it would have been more appropriate to say it was an act of corporate vision about what the future looks like. And essentially, you're saying this is not just good for the public health of America.
Which it is.
But it's obviously good for the ultimate bottom line of CVS.
Exactly. But again, let me wear my historian's cap. The reason most businesses fail isn't because they implode. It's because historically they manage themselves into acceptable decline. Right? Think about General Motors. Right? And so this is a company saying we're going to place a bet. So there's courage even in the strategic bottom line bet that we're going to do something very different. We're going to say no, RJR. You can't sell your stuff here. No, we know you come into the store for a pack of cigarettes. That's why they're right behind the counter. They're no longer going to be that visible, high visibility place with in front of the clerk. No, we're not going to do that.
They be hypocrites? Why can't they? I mean, Marjorie's going to yell at me when I say this, but I'll say it anyway. They're still selling candy bars. They're still selling sugary drinks, but to many people are as serious a problem for the kids of America as cigarettes are for kids and adults in America. Why can't they just be hypocrites, sell cigarettes, and try to become a healthcare company?
Well, it'll be interesting to see as they go further, if I'm right about this, and, Menlo's not being cagey. He says we're positioning ourselves.
Menlo, the CEO.
He's saying it doesn't make sense for us to sell cigarettes and then, try and help people get better.
Yeah.
And I think cigarettes are probably the most glaring example,
drink one Coke a month. Right. I mean, there's a moderation angle with the sugary drinks and candy.
Right. But, I was happened to be in a car the other day, and the guy, my driver, was talking. He'd been a sourcing manager at CVS. Spoke very highly of the company. And he used to source candy, right? Because that's a big driver of traffic in those center aisles.
What does source candy mean?
I mean, he's in charge of buying candy for the store from suppliers. So he deals with sources, right? And we talked about Hershey and Mars and whatnot, and the huge events that generate candy sales. So it'll be interesting to see over time whether they still want to devote so much energy and shelf space and square footage to candy, right, in the wake of what we're talking about as a childhood obesity epidemic. So I think this may only be the first shot over the bow, but some of it, Jim, I think the reason cigarettes first is because cigarettes are so hated in general, even though 18% of Americans smoke, right, down from 40% in 1970, but stalled since 2004, hasn't fallen since 2004. Even though less than 20% of the population smokes, we all know we shouldn't. We all don't want secondhand smoke. We hate cigarettes now, right? I remember when I was a child growing up, my parents all smoked. It was a glamorous thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And now cigarette smokers are outliers and outcasts. So I think this may be the first shot over the bow in terms of what they feel they can sell as they become, if I'm right, and other people aren't saying this as well, more and more of a healthcare company. There's a second piece, though, behind your question, and that is what are consumers in a lather about? So cigarettes, we can all be in a lather about, right? Mm-hmm. Butter versus margarine, right? Beauty products that may use you know, preservatives animal stuff, or animals, yeah. Right? The body of ire is less consolidated, less cohesive, less easy to pinpoint. But consumers are very, very adaptive, as we talked about at other moments on the show. And I suspect that over the next 10 years, we'll get more and more and more things on lists which consumers don't want to tolerate. And if CVS is as foresighted, you know, and in keeping with the curve as they seem to be here, they may be some of the first companies to say, no, we're not doing, you know, cruelty products. Or no, we're only going to allow certain kinds of drinks, juices, right, on our shelves. So a lot of that is about the wave of evolving consumer opinion and lather.
Will they spend money? Will they advertise saying with their CEO, Menlo, or somebody looking at the camera and saying, "We sorry to inconvenience the 18% of you who still smoke, but we decided that we couldn't deal with the inconsistency." Are they going to?
No.
Are they essentially going to promote this, or they just want the news media?
I think they'll
let
the news media do it. They're not really a big kind of like in your face promotional company anyway, right?
But would it sell if it turns out they were the Budweisers of pharmacies and drug? Would the American consumer, if they saw that on television, would they consider that to be something that would cause them to go to CVS rather than Walgreens?
Oh, I think already it's probably causing that. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a little war of words out about whether Walgreens is the real loser in this. And another interesting question is whether it'll put pressure on places like Walmart, right, which sells cigarettes.
Right.
But here's the reason I don't think they'll advertise it, Jim, because only about 5% of all cigarettes in the United States, that's $107 billion worth of cigarettes every year. That's bigger than the beer market, for those of you that are interested.
Really?
Bigger than the beer
it
market.
Is.
Yep. The beer market's about $100 billion. So only about 5% of those cigarettes, right, make it $5 billion and a little change, are actually sold in drugstores. The overwhelming majority are sold in convenience stores.
And gas stations.
And attached gas stations.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
Right.
That makes sense.
So, and, you know, as a couple of articles I read pointed out, you know, they're not going to be throwing out cigarettes anytime soon because, one, you don't have big chains that can make a big impact real quick. You'll have mostly mom and pops in terms of convenience stores. And secondly, right, a lot of people go into a convenience store specifically to buy a pack of cigarettes. So you stop selling cigarettes, you cut a lot of the oxygen out of your cut the oxygen off to your business.
You know, may I just talk about CVS for 1 minute as a healthcare provider? Because
yeah.
I've taken advantage of them, you know, with stuff like flu shots and prescriptions and so forth.
Marjorie had back surgery in Brookline at a CVS a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. It was
phenomenal. No, but seriously, do
wave to the neighbors as they came in, you know, to pick up their stuff.
But think about how aggressively they advertise flu shots, for example.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Well, and they also are really good customer service because CVS, if you have a prescription at CVS, they will call you at home to tell you you should be back for your next prescription. And if your kids have prescriptions and, of course, they lose their strep throat pill or whatever it is, CVS will float you an extra pill for a day or two.
Wow.
And you can't get that if you were going to go, you know, there's so much red tape at the
doctor's. Oh, my God, try doing that at the Brigham, right?
Forget it. Right. But they say your little dingbat kid lost her pills. Okay, we'll give you one until we can get the doctor or that sort of thing.
I feel compelled to say, as does the Walgreens on the Cambridge Sunville line where
I've never
hang out.
I've never dealt with Walgreens.
Saying, yeah.
But the thing is, the comparison to going in for an ear infection or a strep throat to CVS, which is quick and easy, mm-hmm. you're in and out, they're very nice, customer service is great.
No appointments.
I can see this becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. As time goes on.
Absolutely. So, you know, think about the economy as a kind of ecosystem, right? Like, and it's got these interesting Darwinian shocks to it where evolution occurs. So, and new species, you know, mutate. So I think what some of the interesting mutations around, right, both the crisis in the healthcare system and what it means in all kinds of ways, and one big response to it, the Affordable Care Act, is we're going to see these mutations of businesses more and more and more like MinuteClinic, and not just MinuteClinics. We're going to see after-hours care centers, which are freestanding. Maybe CVS will pioneer these as well. Freestanding, you know, places, you know, 3,000 square feet in a strip mall where you can go and get all these different things done along the lines of MinuteClinic, right, with mostly staffed by nurse practitioners who are a lot cheaper, or MAs, medical assistants, or PAs, physician's assistants, much cheaper to do than staffing purely emergency room docs, right? You're going to see more and more and more of those. And all those people that are poured into emergency rooms because they have nowhere else to go will start going to these different mutations. So this is just the beginning of a fascinating set of adaptations that may, the jury's out, may end up delivering value all around.
You know, I don't even know. You mentioned the Affordable Care Act a few minutes ago. How does the Affordable Care Act, if you know, treat these, we're calling them now generically minute clinics? One would assume they would encourage things that they thought were of decent quality, which also are attached to low cost. So this, you would think, would be right up their alley for a whole handful of services. Yep. What's the reimbursement reality?
So,
how does the
answer is I don't know. But what we do know at a very specific level, I don't know if you can get reimbursed for a tonsil check or a strep throat check. What I do know is that the in general, right, the Affordable Care Act and other insurance offerings are basically slowly and steadily or rapidly and steadily raising premiums. So, you know, it makes a lot more sense if you have a really high premium to go spend a little bit of money at a minute clinic versus I think I'll wait in time to see my doctor and pay that bill as part of using up your deductible. A lot more sense.
Or not get healthcare services at all.
Which
I mean,
has
a lot of people have insurance
response.
And can't afford
That's
to
right.
use it,
That's
which,
right.
which obviously could be adjusted as a
Absolutely.
Result of this, too.
So I'm going to bet as well that a lot of these minute clinics are going to have a relationship with insurance companies of whatever ilk in which the patient brokers it. So again, CVS is going to have a cash and carry, credit and carry transaction business. It sure as hell makes accounts receivable, collecting your money a lot easier.
We're talking to Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. Why is there any hesitation from any of the competitors of more than a minute, other than looking like all we do is follow the lead of CVS? There seems to me
That's
to be
really
almost no
question.
Downside here, assuming the margin, not assuming, since the margin Diverse. Is as small as yeah. you suggest and the upside is potentially as big, why are there any holdouts? Or will there be any holdouts in 6 months?
I mean, well, let's take 2 years. I'll bet there won't be any.
Whatever,
I'll bet Target
years.
Will be done. Target will, and I'm sorry, Target's been done for a long time, since the mid-90s, actually. They stopped selling cigarettes in the 90s.
I did not know that.
I think 98, but don't
And by the way, let me interrupt you before you come up with your answer. For those who are listening and saying, well, wait a second, we haven't had these at our pharmacies in Boston for a while. What's going on? There is actually either a law or a resolution or a city council order or something. So they were sort of ahead of the curve. But I interrupted you. So ultimately, you think
convenience stores, no.
Right.
Right.
Because it's such a huge percentage of their...
But lots and lots of other players, yes. Because the profit margins are relatively small. Most cigarettes are still bought not at drugstores or at Walmart, but at convenience stores and gas stations. And lastly, because, you know, there's just increasingly really great data that limit access even the tiniest bit to cigarettes, and you can really, really ratchet down smoking-related illnesses and death in a cohort. So, for example, the Canada has discovered that putting the cigarettes under the lower counter at cashier, where the client, the customer has to ask for it, massively reduces teenage smoking and all the reverb that comes along as you get older and you're still smoking. So just limiting access a little bit has major positive ripple effects. So I think there's going to be pressure lots of different ways, brand-wise, consumer-wise, healthcare-wise, you know, CDC, Center for Disease Control-wise, for lots and lots of players to climb on this bandwagon. It will happen. It's been steadily happening in terms of how smokers are getting ostracized for 20 years. And this is the latest frontier of this.
We only have a minute and a half, and I know this is too broad a question to answer in a short period of time, so I'll ask you anyway. Is being a good corporate citizen, whatever that means, is being a good corporate citizen generally good business? If it turns out we're not going to invest, says this company, we're not going to invest in any companies that do business with X country or invest in this kind of anti-environmental.
Or invest in tobacco companies.
Or whatever it is, right, exactly. Is that generally good business or is that niche market kind of stuff?
So,
meaning, does the general population care?
If they know, there's lots of evidence that they care. There's less evidence that they vote consistently with their wallets. In terms of brand loyalty, especially in products that aren't promotionally priced. What there is that is again less quantifiable, but from my own perspective as a historian, that is very, very interesting, and again, the iceberg, most of it below the surface, the tip now appearing above the water, is this. Consumers who don't feel so enfranchised as voters and members of their kind of town or as members of their communities in terms of their ability to really affect change are using their dollars increasingly right, in all kinds of ways to vote for what they think is good business, whether it's Nike shouldn't use child labor way back in the early 90s.
Locally owned stores,
right, organic milk because we don't want our young girls to all that. It's happening. It's here.
It is happening.
Nancy, you may not know this. Jim loves to ban things and mandate things. And Jack just emailed that Jim must be drooling at the thought of mandating what CVS must take off its shelves next.
I was drooling a little bit just out of one side of my mouth. But I was drooling a little bit. Yes, I
Nancy
was.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. And Nancy is with us every Tuesday. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Chief Justice Margaret Marshall. We're also going to check in with the Boston Globe's editor, Brian McGrory. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Will Roselip, and John Parker. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks so much for listening.